Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got John Venable here. And John is an actor and producer. And in fact, I know him because he produced the fantastic, hilarious short film First Person that was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019. Hey, John.
Hey.
And it's great to have John here. And I'm proud to say that First Person, which is absolutely hilarious, is part of the Discover Indie Film TV series. It's in Season 3, Episode 1, very first film you see, one of the funniest films you'll see, although I think that episode has three great comedies. I love comedy. I think everyone loves comedy. And so we've got John in here to talk about First Person and such. But of course, I always start off asking about your history. What got you into this crazy filmmaking racket?
Wow.
Draws in all kinds of people. So I don't know if you started as an actor and then moved to other parts or started it. So go ahead. Let me know your story.
It's kind of a long story, so I'll try to truncate it. But my buddy Jay back in Texas, Jay Gormley, was just a buddy of mine, and he invited me. It was probably October of 2001, shortly after September 11th. You know, it's like, hey, man, let's go out and have some beers, and I want to talk to you about something. And he had an idea for a feature film, and he said, I want to get the script out there, you know, try to get some people to read it, maybe get it produced, what have you. But I know I won't be able to do any of that if I don't make a short film as kind of a calling card. At least that'll be a big help. He said, but I don't have any ideas for a short film. And I was like, well, that's funny because I have an idea. And I told him the idea and he thought it was cool. And over the next couple of months, you know, we volleyed the script back and forth, wrote it. And then in January, we started casting. And I think by March we had finished shooting, and we just shot it all over one weekend, but you know, and it was awful, like most first short films. You know, it's like, it's one of those things that we don't claim.
And before that, like, had you written any scripts before that, or were you acting before that? Were you just a film enthusiast to that point?
You know, this is one of those things that I didn't want to.
Well, you don't have to.
Well, no, I know I don't have to, but I had quit a very good job to go off into the world of flash animation. I was a web designer and a multimedia artist. Had been doing 3D stuff, a couple different companies, and then I went out to a flash conference in San Francisco and came back and was like, quit my job because I thought I'm going to start reviewing movies and I'm going to build a website that is flash animated, that is reviews of that'll have my reviews of the film, which I was not, you know, a cinema person. All I was doing was basically, in my opinion, I was writing for the common man and was letting them know whether or not the producers of the film had achieved their goal of entertaining their target audience. You know, so I'm not comparing, you know, Art Nouveau from whatever, you know, all sorts of different types of films. I'm just writing about these films, and there's no better education. Well, I guess there is better education, but it's if you're watching every film that comes out in a year and writing your opinion on why it works or it doesn't, you learn a lot about film, you know.
Paying attention to it in a different way. And for anyone who's questioning what John's saying, I can promise you Flash was super rad when it came out. And I too, actually, I got Macromedia Flash and I was like, can I learn how to do this? I couldn't even draw a penis. I was just trying to draw a dick. I wanted dicks talking to each other. And
right.
I didn't have the skills, but yeah, Flash was huge and super tempting.
Right. Well, I'll just send you some of the stuff that I did if I can. I need to dig up some of the.
Yeah. You would have like a really cool looking character you created, like, and you would do the voice.
I had a whole stable of characters that I did. I did an impression of Carl from Sling Blade, and this is the thing: the characters didn't. They reviewed the films as well, but they didn't have to agree with me. So I could love a film, and then Carl could come on and talk about how terrible it was based on his life experience. You know.
So you could really have fun with it.
Yeah. And I had the Supercala, it was supercala.com was the, that was part of the business plan, was to hopefully have Disney sue me. Because I was using initially supercalifragilistic.com.
So you figured all press is good press.
Yeah, that they would send a cease and desist, it would make a big story out of it, and then I would change the name. You know, they didn't care. They didn't know I existed. But the different characters. I had Carl from Sling Blade. I had one called Goofy Bear, which was just a big bear, big dumb bear. The Supercala Choir, which I composed vocal parts. I'm a choir geek growing up. My mom's a music teacher. I'm a musician. So I was writing music for stuff. I was doing choral arrangements for that. And then I had the Stick Figure Punk Band, which had the same, but they had the same count off and the same drum line in every song, but it was a different, you know, a different song for each film that they reviewed. But it was very labor intensive. You know, initially I started out doing one or, you know, if I reviewed four movies in a week, I would do one or two of them that had animations that went along with them. And by the end of the existence of this, I had gotten to the point where I was doing one animation every 4 weeks. And, you know, it just sucked because when I got in on the ground floor of Flash and this was when advertising had just taken off.
Yeah. I was going to say there was no revenue model yet at all.
Yeah.
YouTube wasn't even profitable back then.
Yep. And big advertisers were spending, $20 or $30 per 1,000, you know, show their banner ads. I forget all the verbiage for it now, but anyway, by the time I got my site up and by the time I had a following of about 5,000 people that would regularly come to the site, it had gone from $30 per 1,000 down to like $1.50. So I made enough money off of the site to pay my cell phone bill, basically, at the end of the month.
And maybe web hosting.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Maybe. And it just got to the point where it was like, I don't know how much longer I'm going to do this. And then I wrote and directed and produced my first feature film. And I was like, you know what? It probably would not behoove me to still be talking about other people's films when I have something in the market.
And did that feature film come before the one you worked on with your friend or after? When your friend said, I want to make a short and I have no idea.
Oh, it was well after that. Yeah.
We had already
made.
That was the first film.
Yeah. The first feature and the only feature that I've made to this point. And it got distribution. It was, I made it at the time. We made it at the time when we got ready to go to market is when the economy went to hell in a handbasket in 2008.
Right. But actually, so the Flash series in a way was your film school.
Yeah.
And then after having
the writing reviews. Yeah.
Yeah. After having really paid attention to films for a year plus.
Well, no, I probably did that for 6 years.
Oh, wow. So a long time.
Yeah. I was a member of a voting body, the Dallas Fort Worth Film Critics Association, you know, where we would vote for, you know, the best and worst movie of the year, blah, blah, blah. And I'll give out all sorts of awards and stuff. But
And that's when your buddy came to you and said, I want to make a film, but I have no ideas.
Let's see. I think I started the movie review stuff like about a year before that. So it was, you know, kind of coincided. It was about 12 months apart. My education with doing movie reviews and then my education producing the shorts that we wrote together, Jay and I, you know, we learned a lot off of every filmmaker does, you know, each one you do, you get better by the next one. And if you don't, you'll probably run out of steam pretty quick and just move on to some other hobby.
You would think, although, whatever. I mean, you can laugh. We can laugh at the, I was almost going to name a famous filmmaker who's pretty much like never moved that needle, but yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, but So I quit doing that in 2006, and then but I'd been acting before then as well, because after I did our first film, and then maybe another film, I decided that casting yourself in your own films is no proof that you can act. So I went and started auditioning for other people's short films. And then when I was at one of these auditions, I saw a posting for a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And I was like, you know what? I sang and did musicals in high school. It's like, I really enjoyed that. I'm going to go audition for that, you know, and started auditioning in theater. And then I did a ton of theater while I was in Dallas-Fort Worth, and actually earned my equity card while I was there. And that was my original intention, was to move to New York and go and try to do the Broadway things. I've got friends who are up there that have been doing very well. And I know not everybody does well.
This hasn't happened to me in a while.
Now I got something to cut. All right, go on. I'll give myself a note.
But somewhere in that time,
right, so you're auditioning in Dallas and you were thinking of going to New York?
Or? I actually did. After I earned my equity card, I went up to New York and stayed with my friends, Brian and Ashley. Brian has been in the production of Aladdin since it started its workshops, and he's still in it. He's been in it on Broadway for however long it's been running now. But they, you know, I would stay with them when I went up there, and I did audition for a Broadway production of Annie, which was a show I did in high school, the very first show I did in high school. It was kind of a symmetry there, which was funny. But during that time, actually, or before that, Jay and I had written a feature-length script called $30,000 Millionaires, which was Jay's idea, but we wrote it together, and it's written in his voice. It actually, and then I built a flash website for it, and we had a website about a script go viral. It was crazy because we put it up, and I'm tracking it on this little web tracking software that I have. And, you know, in a week we had 60,000 viewers, you know, 60,000 individual people come by the website and look at a website that has, you know, they can't see a movie. They can't see a...
Right. You didn't even have sample pages up. You just were about the script.
We had a trailer that had a whole ton of stock footage in it and a voice, not even a voiceover. It just had, some cool music. And I don't even remember, but it caught the attention of the assistant of my manager, who is still my literary manager here in LA. And, so one time I came out to talk to her, and she's just like, what are you doing? Why are you in Dallas? Come out here. You know, you can come to our, she does a workshop every weekend, and it's been on Zoom lately, obviously. But you know, I learned so much in there, and she represents writers mainly for TV. So, you know, I had to transition from writing feature length scripts to doing TV, and I've had meetings in town for, but I haven't gotten hired or anything. When you're, and she says this, you know, when you're older, and I'm over 50, you know, that's just not what they're looking for as a junior writer in a writer's room. You know,
there are prejudices.
There are, and that's okay. I get it, but I think that probably comes from them trying it out before, you know, hiring a 50 something and that person just going, F it. You're not paying me enough to do this job. And, you know, them walking away or
they're not confident enough to say, you know what? I think they just like someone younger. So they can say, you don't know what you're doing. You have to listen to me.
Maybe so.
I think there's always an insecurity and a hierarchy in this industry.
Right.
So it's not to be totally negative, but.
Yeah, well,
I remember those writers who faked their age and stuff so that they could seem like they were 25, even though they were in their, you know, like the 40-year-old who wrote, what was it? I'm forgetting now. Wasn't it the Ben Stiller movie about kids? Well, anyway.
The Fat Camp movie?
No, I'm actually thinking of the one with him and Ethan Hawke and Winona.
Was it Singles? Reality Bites.
Reality Bites.
Yeah.
Was that, it wasn't that writer, was it? But there was a,
I can't recall.
There's like a famous story, like the screenwriter, like she looked young, so she lied about her age. And they were like, oh my God, this amazing script from a 22-year-old.
Right.
Anyway. Right. I'm distracting from your stories.
No, that's fine. They produced a whole television show on that called Younger, where it's somebody faking that they're younger and having to keep up the ruse the entire time.
Yet another TV show where they stole an idea from real life.
From film. But anyway, that feature, it never did get produced, but we did get into development with Dune Entertainment, who they may not still be, but they were the money behind 20th Century Fox. They were the money behind Avatar. And they had a deal with Fox that was better than a first look deal. It was, walk a script into us and we'll produce it. And we were that first script. We were going to get that. It was amazing. Cherie had sent it out everywhere, and a lot of people were interested and wanted meetings with us, which basically means, you go around and do the water bottle tour and you talk to people and they like your writing, but they want to meet you, but they're not interested in buying it right now.
Yeah. In fact, they say to you, what else do you have?
Right. And we had a pitch worked up for a different script that we were working on. But Dune actually wanted it. But since they're the only ones that come to the table and we were nobodies from Texas, there was no option on it because there wasn't another company.
They had no motivation to lock it up.
There was no bidding war.
Right.
But, so anyway, we were in development with them for a year. And initially, they agreed with our vision of it, which was, a little indie film along the line of Swingers. Like a $5 to $8 million film. Slow rollout in theaters and see what happens. And somewhere along the line, they changed their mind about it. And they're like, we really like this. And we want it to be a bigger film. We want it to be a $25 million film.
Right, and grab a big name for it.
Yeah. Cause all of our ideas for casting were, people who were on television shows who love television, but they're already rich from doing television. So they don't need a huge payday to go do a film. They want to do film because they're doing TV, but I think that Dune wanted to go get, a bigger name or two or three.
Yeah, and is this that late 90s Swingers era sort of?
Yeah, or? It was after that. And this, actually the script itself is about, it's about the subculture of douchebags that live in any sort of city like Dallas, take it, Indianapolis, Atlanta, just think of anything that isn't New York or LA or San Francisco that is a big city. It's the guys who fake being rich so that they can hook up with the women who are chasing the real millionaires. And, everything they own is leased and whatever. So it's a coming of age story for the 20 to 30 something douchebag,
I see why it was on the cusp, because it's a great idea.
At least it was back then. But if you read the script now, there's no way it could get produced
because these guys
are just being complete chauvinistic assholes, which is what they are, they're in the club scene and it was all about getting laid. And,
yeah.
And,
there's our argument. Swingers wouldn't play now in a way, because Swingers was. But I guess you can chase women while respecting them. But obviously, your script, there was a lack of respect.
Right, there was, except for the main character.
Yeah.
He was the one that had a coming of age for a 30-something.
But brother, I brought up the era that you were pursuing it, because when you mentioned TV talent,
mm-hmm.
of course, now finally the wall between TV talent and movie talent is broken. But back then it was still like so rare. If someone was on a TV show, studios were like, well, they can't be the lead in a film because people know them from TV. Like,
yeah,
that was still a hard rule.
Yeah, that was really odd. And now, yeah, it doesn't matter. You flip back and forth seamlessly and everybody's making money all over the place. But yeah, Jay was a news reporter, and he works, in the upper management at a huge cable company. So he had more money than me. So we actually hired a casting director out here, Lindsay Shagg. And we had John Grise or Grease, who was Uncle Rico of Napoleon Dynamite, playing one of the characters. He wasn't one of the douchebags. Ivana Milicevic was our female lead, and she was in, a Showtime show. Oh gosh, now I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, she was great. She was a Bond girl. She's been in a bunch of stuff. You would recognize her. And who else did we have? We had somebody else. But anyway, you know, we got to the point where we're packaging, you know, a few actors and Sharit and the guys at Dune found a director for us. The guy that worked on all the Farrelly Brothers films. And, you know, it just never happened. And at the end of the process, you know, they basically just flipped the script back to us and said, thanks, but we're going to go over here and make the A-Team and Avatar 2 and what have you.
Yeah,
and,
you know,
it's back to business as usual.
And because it sounds like the way everything evolved, you never got that sweet six-figure option check.
No.
Yeah, and which is such a punch.
Yeah, it really was. And on top of that, although, you know, we both got a lot of great learning out of it, which, you know, it sucks when everything in life is a learning experience. You know, it would be nice to have a paycheck attached to it here and there. But, you know, during development, you know, we rewrote it so many times and we didn't get a dime for any of that. But that was fine because we were working together with Dune as a team to bring the picture to the screen. That's what development is about. You know, you get it to the point where it's like everybody is in agreement. This is the best version of this. And they just felt like it never got there, which is why I really had hoped in the end, it's like, okay, well, you didn't like to where it got, but you know, everybody in Hollywood, why don't you go hire, you know, a Don Ruse, someone who's a script doctor, and have them punch it up. Somebody who has skins on the wall, somebody who knows what they're doing. If you really love the idea so much, go pay somebody, because you didn't have to waste any money on us. You know, go pay somebody $250,000 to do a rewrite on the idea, the conceit of the film, and then see if you like that version to make the $25 million picture. But they weren't interested in that.
I mean, this is an unfair, biased question, but I mean, in your mind, would it have been just as good to go back to the original vision? I mean, did it truly get better through that process, or was it just, you know, killing it by committee?
You know, Jay, I think, would say that it did get, that it lost, and in fact, he did say at some points the stuff that we were asked to do, it lost a little bit of the heart that it had at its center. But it also, it gained stakes that it didn't have before, you know, and like I said, it was all a learning experience, you know, and Sheree told us, you know, that, you know, they didn't feel like that you guys were good enough to bring it up to the level of a $25 million film, which, you know, we were just happy to be repped and to like be getting to this point where we have something that's all, damn, this thing might get made.
It's such a weird way to say it too, right? Because we've all seen films that were like a bad script that was a $100 million film.
Right.
It's so strange to me that, but the development process is, no one really knows what's going on with it.
Yeah.
The people asking for the changes don't really know what they like when they see it. I mean, not to be biased that way, but, you know, it's not like you could have presented. I am now speaking on your behalf, saying you could hand them like pure gold and like they're not really reading it front to back. They're having an assistant read it and write coverage and give them opinions. And it's, I don't know, it's such a, rubs me the wrong way hearing about it, I guess.
Yeah.
I feel for you.
I'm not going to be sour grapes about it because, you know, it really depressed Jay because this was Jay's baby. But I was very much, dude, this is the status quo.
Absolutely the status quo. That's what, oh my God, I know many, not many, but I have a handful of people I know who sold many scripts to studios, mostly 90s, 80s, 90s, mm-hmm. and they have big homes in Encino, and nothing ever made it to screen. They just kept getting optioned and getting paid to, you know.
It's amazing, yeah.
There's actually a friend whose wife had a master's in history from UT in Austin.
Oh,
and
cool.
So every historical script they threw at her, like, you know, whether it was, you know, Troy or JFK or this or that, like, she was getting paid for things that never hit the screen.
Right.
It's wild.
Right. But back to the development process, I don't think that they ever led us so far astray that it got bad. But, you know, you think you hear about the, you know, the Kevin Smith story of going in on, I forget what film it was. It may have been his pitch of Superman or something, but the guy said, let's put some mechanical spiders in it. Can we do that? And, you know, Kevin Smith does those whole spoken word things where he just talks about his experiences in Hollywood. And that one is effing hilarious because that's how those spiders ended up in that movie Wild Wild West, which is just nuts because this is that guy inserting himself into their script. And it had nothing to do with the script. It had to do with the guy, his daughter's.
Justifying his paycheck.
Yeah, well.
By making a change.
And his daughter's. Wanted mechanical spiders in something, and that was his justification for it. It's just so funny.
Have you heard the old parable about the screenwriter and the producer crawling through the desert, dying of thirst, covered in sand? They finally see an oasis. They make it up to the oasis. The screenwriter dips his hand in the fresh, clean water and is about to lift it to his mouth, and then he sees urine splashing onto his hand, and he looks up, and the producer says, "Don't worry, I'm making it better." that was told to me by an old fashioned screenwriter, an old timer. It was like, yeah, they just I've got to put myself in it somehow, so I'm gonna piss on it.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. I haven't had to get that real experience yet, other than this one, which I still think was a pretty good one. But
right.
I would welcome somebody optioning a script and then, you know, pissing onto it at this point.
For sure, for sure. You just have to pay to piss.
Right.
Is the deal, right? All right, so what happened with you? And were you auditioning through this whole process too? Were you staying to that?
I was back in Texas because I was still living in Texas when we were flying out here to take all the meetings and stuff. And while we were in development with that was all done in Texas. And then I moved out here in 2013. But before that, I was, you know, auditioning, or, you know, I did an episode of Friday Night Lights and was auditioning in Shreveport all the time when, after Katrina came through and wiped out, you know, the New Orleans film industry, it all moved up to Shreveport. And, you know, so driving out there to audition and Dallas to audition and Oklahoma and, you know, doing a lot of commercials and industrials, and there wasn't a whole lot of TV and film, but it happened every so often.
Yeah. Coincidentally, I guess it kind of grew once Georgia, when Atlanta became a hub about a decade later.
Atlanta has done what Texas wanted to do with Austin, because Austin, everybody wanted Austin to be the third coast, quote unquote, you know, come make your film in Texas. You know, we've got all these tax incentives and, but Atlanta obviously did it so much better. Had so much more infrastructure, or if they didn't have it, they built it, I guess.
And they had the advantage of having cable network space there, right?
Yeah.
So that was,
I guess,
that was an edge. CNN started there, and then the whole...
And their state really got behind it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Texas is it's kind of a purple state now, but back then it was definitely a red state. And, you know, the more conservative-leaning people in the state didn't... You know, it was a fight just to keep the funding. It was not ever about really increasing it. It was just whatever level we had gotten it to, that, you know, some legislators had gotten some sort of funding, tax breaks. It was never going to increase, but it was a fight just to keep it. And New Mexico right next to us.
New Mexico.
Kicking our butt. I mean, everybody around us doing fantastic. It's like, you know, I think Michigan was probably the only one that offered really huge incentives and then just totally failed. You know, they produced some stuff up there, but in the end, you know, it didn't work out. And I think that's kind of what happened in Texas, a lot slower over several years. But there's people going back there now. There are things being produced there.
It's actually a fascinating, you're bringing up the fact that there actually is a marketplace of municipalities fighting for film production.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you live in LA, like, you're highly aware of it, you know, because... First, Vancouver was stealing jobs, and then, you know, and then a lot of stuff shifted, to Albuquerque and Atlanta. It's been...
Louisiana. Louisiana's huge.
For a little while, Hawaii was offering massive incentives, but, you know, kind of expensive to get there.
Right. But California just came out with some new ones.
We finally reacted, right?
Yeah. Yeah, to try and keep productions here, you know. It's like, what did Netflix just move to Albuquerque or something?
I think so. Netflix, I mean, they have a huge presence here still, but yeah.
Yeah, but I think they're going to be producing a lot of stuff in New Mexico, you know.
Yeah.
It's great. I've got some friends that live there that work crew. They're going to be
That's all from Breaking Bad, right? Breaking Bad pretty much made that happen.
I would imagine, yeah.
Crazy.
And being in Dallas, we actually got to audition for that stuff. I mean, that's how, you know, you met Charles, who's the star of First Person.
Oh, that's right. That's
you
right.
You know, he...
I'm mentioning Breaking Bad, and I am forgetting that you have a main Breaking Bad character in First
Person.
And
I was just hanging out with him today. I was helping him audition a film role. I was just being on the other side of the camera reading with him. He auditioned for a role called Skinny Stoner that was only going to shoot one day. And he went in, and everybody liked him so much, they gave his character a name, Skinny Pete. And the rest is history. You know, he was in the finale. He was in El Camino, huge part of an El Camino. And,
beloved, you know, character.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you were in Dallas and an actor who was, you know, good, I got to audition for three different times. I could show the episodes like, okay, I auditioned for that guy and that one and then that one. But Dallas.
So all that was pre 2013 because you said you moved out here 2013.
Yeah,
8 years ago.
Yeah, coming up on 8 years. Yeah. Not proud of that because I've heard that, you know, most people don't make it past the 5 year mark, and that, you know, even more, you know, the people who come out here with absolutely no acting talent and or idea or how everything works. You know, come out here and be gone in a year or two, you know, because they see a reality show and they think, well, I can do that. Well, it's not acting. It's a reality show. You know, you're not going to end up on Friends. You know, here I am pulling that very current sitcom Friends. But, you know, Courtney Cox was not a nobody when she got cast in that. You know, Matt LeBlanc had been. You know,
they'd all been bopping around,
yeah.
Pilots and recurring roles. Yeah, Courtney got her big break on Family Ties, right? So she was Michael J. Fox's girlfriend like last season.
I didn't even know that. I thought it was the Bruce Springsteen video.
Well, that probably that was first, but she didn't speak. But
right.
But she got to talk on Family. Yeah, go figure.
But yeah, people. Anyway. Yeah, this town will dash some dreams rather quickly once you get out here and figure out that oh, that's how it works. Okay.
Look, I always feel awkward talking about it, but mm-hmm. The fact is it's one of the hardest things in the world to crack into, and no one knows the magic formula, and I've personally known super talented people who just never got acknowledged and never got a break, and less talented people who ended up, you know, making
superstars,
it.
Superstars, man.
Not so. I wish I knew a superstar, believe me. But,
right, right.
But, yeah, it's just, there's no rhyme or reason, honestly. I have no idea. That's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about the indie films at the festivals, honestly, because I feel like that's where the talent is, and that's where, like, if festivals are run correctly, that's where the merit, you know, the best rise to the top, and
mm-hmm.
and it's people doing it for the right reasons because they just really care about it, and they're either devoted to filmmaking itself or to the project they happen to be involved in with that. And I just think it's such a, I just love indie film for that because,
right.
You know, when I've gone to festivals that are show all studio films, you know, even, you know, the premiere side of Sundance, and it's like, it's just, you know, those films are being made. There's an artist somewhere who's trying to make it the best film it can be while satisfying all these commercial restraints and the committees. It's tough. So
yeah, totally.
That's one reason why I'm so passionate about these indies, because I feel like it's, I grew up, we're about the same age. I grew up on punk rock, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
like, the real, you know, not that I don't like yacht rock, but.
But yeah, listening to, you know, Husker Du instead of Steely Dan, you know, there's a very different aesthetic. And
hair metal, right? Hair metal was like the ultimate thing where like they just went and said, okay,
put on wigs, put on makeup, and we'll shoot a music video and change your sound to sound a little bit like, you know, everyone's just imitating Van Halen.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
I'm cynical on that.
Right. Right. Now the, independent films, yeah, it's great because there's so much passion. There's people trying to get their stuff out there. And the sad thing is, well, the great thing about independent film is the smaller the budget, the more contained the size of the crew and the cast, the more absolute control that, that the person who's trying to bring it to screen has of their vision. You have somebody come in and say, okay, I love that script. Let's go produce it for $10 million. All of a sudden, there's all sorts of influence.
There has to be.
Yeah, yeah, there has to be because they're safeguarding their $10 million. But it's also control, you know, that, and it's like the more, that's one thing that you learn very quick, whether it's as an actor or writer, producer, what have you, is the more money that's involved in a project, the less control the creatives get, you know, in the end. It, because, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's let's make some money. Let's go make some money.
And that's why, you know, indie films have always been the home where, the marginalized get a little more featured, whether it was, you know, gay cinema or, mm-hmm. or, you know, interracial relationships, all kinds of things, you know, subjects, stories, indie. I just think indie film is where it's at.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, there's something big that is a little daring and surprising, but it's, your job is kind of not to surprise you. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, if the money people can't quantify what you're doing, then they're not interested in giving you money. And if they can't quantify what you're doing, you might be onto something really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's an idea that they haven't done, and they don't know of any other films that they can compare the box office receipts to your film, potentially.
Yeah.
You might be onto something. So it takes producers with a vision, you know, the ones that do come in and scoop up projects and, you know, maybe give somebody $2 million to go make a film. You know, I think those would probably be a fantastic type of film to work on because you're not having to kill yourself to make your film. Like my feature, we shot it over 7 weekends in a row. And I would never do that to a film crew again because everybody was working their 5-day work week. And then we shot Saturday and Sunday, you know, and we're all just killing ourselves doing it.
Yeah. And probably cramming in 10, 15 page days.
Yeah. Just everything's just hauling ass.
Very hard.
If you have you know, the bigger budget like that, you could slow down and breathe.
Yeah, it's funny listening to you. I was thinking, I guess the math would work out. If you could get 10 people to give $200,000 each, then no one has a bigger voice than, like, hopefully, like, $200,000 they can invest and walk away and say, if I lose it, great. Or if I lose it, okay. If it becomes something big, great. But, like, no one can say, I gave you. But anyway.
Right.
We're totally off of your story here, yeah. So I'm going to push it back on you.
Yeah, yeah.
No, because so was there anything critical in your decision to move out to L.A. in 2013?
What do you mean by critical?
Well, I don't know. What finally pushed you? Yeah.
What Sheree had said to me, it rang home. It's like, what are you doing? Why are you still living there? You know, there's so much more opportunity here. This is the town, whether or not it actually films here, this is where all the decisions get made.
And where the meetings are held.
Yeah. And I was like, well, that makes a lot of sense. I can go give the writing thing a shot. And on top of that, I'm an actor and there's plenty of acting stuff going on. So I can give that a shot. And so for, you know, I made the decision, yeah, I'm going to do it. And then, for a year and a half, I pretty much quit going out and I paid off all my debts and saved up as much money as I could before I moved out here. And I would give that advice to any young person who is moving out here.
Don't show up with debt.
Don't show up with debt. Show up with as much money as you can have and have a place lined up to live and have a job lined up. You know, and if not a job prospects or at least the humility to drive Uber or DoorDash, or whatever.
Yeah, have that part-time thing that allows you to audition or allows you to write.
Right.
Because, yeah.
The side gigs and what have you. Because this town can run you out of town. I can't imagine having moved out here in my 20s or 30s. I think I probably would have been back home in 6 months because I would have been out in the bars chasing tail and just spending money I didn't have. And it would have gone very poorly, you know. Because back in Dallas, you could do everything for 1/8 of the cost, you know, going out to the bars there and hanging out. But here, yeah, this can be an expensive town, especially if you wanted to be part of a certain scene.
And, but, you know, every famous person has a story. I know Anna Kendrick was like folding clothes at Express when she was auditioning, and John Krasinski was waiting tables the day before and after he auditioned for The Office. And he was like, well, that, you know, I just auditioned for that. But what are the odds that pilot even gets picked up? I got to show up at the restaurant tomorrow and take orders again. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not glamorous.
Right. But it's necessary, you know, and I think that moving out here at a, at an advanced age in my, late 40s, made all the difference in the world. I thought it was actually going to work out great for me because I'm going to be here. I am walking into town, a brand new face who is in his late 40s. How often does that happen? You know, most everybody that's moving to town is in their, you know, their 18, 19, 20,
absolutely. 20,
25 and under. This is going to be great for me, a windfall, because they're going to, guess what? I didn't think about the guys who had been here for 30 years already, who are my age and already have all the contacts and have been working. And yeah, so it's just as hard, no matter what age group you're in, you're going to have, it's a struggle. There's no other way to put it. I mean, it's, you know, some people immediately get snapped up when they move out here because, you know, their talent just can't be ignored. And then for the rest of us who are, you know, fighting for all the 5 and under roles on TV shows and little things in film, it's, you know, there's whatever, 40 people that go in for an audition and one person's going to come away happy. And that's, you have to be able to deal with that. And if you can't, you can't do this business.
And if you're one of the 40 who's getting pulled in, that's an accomplishment.
Absolutely. And you have to recognize that. You say, I got called in for this. That's wonderful. Like I've had 3 auditions in the last 2 weeks. During the pandemic, I let my hair get down all the way to my shoulders. And I had the biker look, had a Fu Manchu mustache, was hoping that, you know, I might get hired to do that, you know, to look like one of the guys that stormed the Capitol or
show up on like a show like the Mayans.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
anything,
biker gang.
Anything like that. But the dudes like that, you know, they're already well established too. And it's like, but then, plus I don't think anybody just buys me as a badass. They don't look at me and think that dude's bad news. You know? In fact, I had a casting director tell me that. It's just like, no, just like you exude something that is the opposite of that. And
really, even when you had the,
long hair, because it's, and I always talked about that because I played in a metal band, you know, back in the 80s, I played in a band that opened for Pantera back in the day and, had long hair, but I don't think anybody ever bought me. They're like, that's just some frat guy with long hair, which they were right, you know? And, and I've always looked like a even when I had long hair or was just in plain clothes, I looked like a cop on his day off, you know, or a narc. So just one of those things. But anyway, I get my hair cut and boom, I got 3 auditions for within 2 weeks for huge shows, which I was incredibly grateful for. Cause like
yeah,
you said,
congrats.
Thanks. I mean, it's an accomplishment in this town just to get called in. Cause I don't even think it's 40. I think it's 32. And actually, when they're calling in 32, they're calling in maybe 20 people that they already know who are a lot of their regular go-tos. And then maybe a couple of people that the producers have asked for. So there's actually a very, depending on what the project is, you know, it could be the entire 32. And I don't even know if I made that number up or what. It could be the entire 32, or it could be 8 that got chosen from photographs to come in. Cause they're flipping through, you know, swiping through headshots and then, you know, see a headshot, oh, like that, click on your headshot, see a little bit of what your resume is. okay, yeah, let's go ahead and call him in. That's an achievement in this town.
Well, no, it absolutely is. And getting in there, also, I mean, you never know what's going to hit, but getting in there and auditioning, it's a muscle, right? You've got to mm-hmm. stay in shape. And all the self-taping and practice in the world ain't like being in that room, right?
Right, because you you don't get to sell yourself, because that's why I really want things to go back to in-person auditioning soon, but I know that's not going to happen. Is that same casting director that I talked to, I asked her, so is self-tape going to be the thing moving forward? And she's like, for a while, you know, it'll probably shift back a little bit, but, you know, in the long run, casting directors have always liked self-tapes because there's no overhead and we can see people from all over. It doesn't have to be people who are local to LA. We can have auditions from people who are in Hawaii and New York and whatever. But callbacks, there's some sort of optimism that she gave me. She said that, you know, I see callbacks being more in person pretty soon. Once things get a handle on things, which, you know, hope is sooner than later. But anyway, yeah, the chance to just walk in the room being yourself and whatever vibe you give off, if they like it, that's half the battle.
For sure. And clearly that's part of it. Clearly it has to be. I mean, I can't imagine casting someone without ever having been in a room with them. I mean, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. I understand COVID made everything different.
Right.
But honestly, I'm surprised that they're just not casting people, you know, on a grassy area of the studio, you know, or wherever they, you know, yeah. I guess casting, yeah. Most casting is actually done in offices, but you know what I mean? Like just go to a patio if you don't want to be in a breathing space. I don't know. Hopefully there won't be too many variants beyond Delta, but
right.
It's a weird time. It's a very weird time for that.
Truly is. Yeah.
Well, you want to jump into when First Person came to be?
Sure. I had gone to a party over at Charlie Baker's house, the aforementioned Skinny Pete, because he had been getting together a group of people who were from Texas, inviting all of them, and then inviting some more of his LA friends, and everybody's intermingling and what have you. And I'd made friends with a couple of the guys that were regulars at these parties. And this one particular night that I came in, it's like Charlie Baker. I was like, man, when are we going to do something together? It's been a while. You know, because that's how I met Charlie. We offered him a film in a role in a short film before I ever left Texas. I didn't know him, but I knew his agent. So Charlie mentioned it to me. And then Charles Halford, who, if you looked him up, you would know him. He's got an incredible resume. He was the first season of True Detective. You remember the first time we see the bad guy that has the gas mask on and a machete and his tidy whities walking through the forest? That's Charles. Charles is a badass but an incredibly sweet person. And he's like, dude, when are we going to do something together? And then Patrick, another friend, a guy who's in Sin City, he's been in some good stuff too. He's like, dude, when are we going to do something? I'm like, holy crap. It's like, I've got three actors who are recognizable from film and TV talking to me about this. And I went home and I was like, I'm going to write something because I got to write something for the four of us. And I went home and I churned out three different short scripts, and sent them to each of the guys. And they're like, dude, they're all good. I was like, okay, let's start producing them. But then I thought, you know what? This was really fun. This was a fun process to write towards something and towards someone. And so it's like I had Charlie, Charles, and Patrick, and I'm writing towards them and including me in there as well. And the words just spilled out. And it was so easy. Like I said, I wrote three short scripts like that. And I was like, what if we offered that opportunity for other people all around the world, you know, to have a recognizable actor from film and TV, up front, we tell you, okay, Charles Baker is going to be our male star. and Brina Palencia is going to be our female star. She was the one that played the telephone pole. And Brina had been in Star-Crossed, and she's done like 200 different anime titles and voiceovers. She's a huge in that world. So anyway, you know, writing, give people the opportunity to write towards people that they had seen on TV and in film. And then whoever wins it, we produce it. I came up with that idea. I went back to the guys and was like, what do you think about this? How about we produce? Let's figure out which one of these three scripts is our favorite one. It's the best one. Let's produce it. No, actually, we were just going to produce all three. We were going to use all three as calling cards for the festival. And we did a Kickstarter or whatever. And we raised enough money to produce one and then have money left over to run the festival. But anyway, that was that would have been Last Will and Testament Incorporated, which was the first film that we made as a promotion for the cumbersome name, the Hollywood... the Hollywood Connection Short Screenplay Competition, which is also shortscreenplay.com. It should have just called it that. Some version of that.
You know, a lot of people say you got to put the word Hollywood in there, so right. I get it.
Well, and because it says everything you need to know. Hollywood Connection, we're giving you someone who is recognizable from film and TV in a film that we will produce for you if your script wins. And so we did that, and then I... traveled around with that film as it made its festival run. It made it debuted, had its world premiere at the Dead Center Film Festival in Oklahoma City, which is a big one. And then it made it in, and actually won a couple of festivals. one like best short, not just best comedy short at one, and then best comedy short at another one. They're smaller ones, but it's still really cool to be recognized that way. And then just went to all the ones that I could that, you know, I had the money to travel to, and as at any festival, there's a Q&A afterward, and you get up to talk, and that's how I was promoting shortscreenplay.com. And then we had our first season, and Eric Eilenberger sent in the winning script, and we produced it and had an entire festival run with that, and it made it into the Sherman Oaks Film Festival as well.
I would be shocked. I say this a lot, but I would be shocked. Who wouldn't like that film? I mean, it's pithy. It's hilarious. The performances are great. All the performances. I love all the, you know, people he's voicing over for.
Right.
Everybody's hilarious. Yeah, and you recognize a lot of the actors. But whether or not you recognize them or not, they're just great. In fact, I watched it again before talking to you, and like one of the notes I love is his annoying boss when like she's got one expression when she's lecturing him in his voice, and then when like she looks at her phone, she gives like a friendly little, I'm going to go to like,
right.
Like there's actually subtlety in the performances of that. Like absolutely. It just came out great.
Yeah. That was Bridget. She did a great job, but that was, director. He did a fantastic job. You know, he asked her to do that, and you know, she's somebody that I was in acting class with, so I know what her acting chops are like. And then when you were talking about, you know, it's a muscle, the audition muscle. That's why everybody in LA is in acting classes, because you're not always getting auditions, but you have to keep that muscle at the ready.
Yeah, yeah, it's the acting class is the gym. If you're not working out, you really think you can pull it off?
Yeah. So those
and
were...
And by the way, as I noted watching it, you were the editor.
Mm-hmm. I was. I am.
And it's very well edited. I mean, it's snappy. By the way, we've talked about comedy being hard for actors and comedy being hard for filmmakers and directors. Editing comedy is a special skill. I've actually seen many comedy that was funny on the set or funny on the page, funny on the set. First cut, not funny, and you have to bring in someone who knows how to cut funny.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely the comedic timing, and you know where to give things air and what have you. And you know, Michael, I didn't mention Michael's name, the director. You know, he was, I edited, but you know, it was his call at the end of the day. What the cut, I gave him final cut because you know you're director. So retreating it like we're a small movie studio that produces short films, and what even that means when your script wins, it means we're going to go through a development process with it too. You know, we're going to punch up a few things here and there. We're going to take away a few of these things that you've written in there that are way too prohibitively expensive for us to do and replace them with things, you know, and we'll do that with the writer if they have the time and the desire. Or if not, we'll just do it for them.
Right, which is cool because instead of picking the script that was the best and doable, you just picked the best script and then you worked with it from there.
Well, no, because the competition, it does have rules. You know, we have a page limit, which I think is 12 pages. Because, you know, just obviously the longer you get, the more expensive things get, you know, the more days you have. But I think we figured out that, you know, if a 12-page script at most, if you're humming, will probably take 2.5 days at the most. And depending on how many different locations you have and what have. But there is a list of recommendations that I put in the rules. You know, it's like, here's the deal. It's like, if you can't afford to film a car crash, think about us. We can't either. You know, and if you need laser cats shooting spaceships, we can't do laser cats either because we don't have, you know, the CGI budget. So keep that in mind when you're writing because, and I did this, you know, for some people, I'd write back to them after they'd sent their script in and give them an opportunity to pull something out. You know, it's like, can we go ahead and take this element out and send me that draft back? You know, because we can't do that. Because in the end, the people who judge the scripts are the actors that we have that we've told you you're writing toward. And like with our most recent one, the second iteration, which we haven't gotten to produce the film yet because COVID happened and there were some other delays, and we are we are way, way behind in getting that one done. But I do have the money now to do it, and Dean Cameron is our star. So Dean and Milena Govich was originally going to be our female star, and she was someone from Law and Order and a bunch of what was the fire, the Dennis Leary fireman show. She was in Rescue Me. She had a good role in that as well. And now all she's doing is directing. She's like directing Chicago Fire, Chicago, all the Chicago things. I think she's been directing on all those, and she's just killing it. But before that happened, she was one of the judges, and as was Dean. And so they're the ones that read the scripts, you know. So a writer here and there, I would give them the opportunity to, like, you know, do this.
Right. So that's actually an incredibly fair contest of sorts, because here you are, they're getting a chance to. It's almost like when the teacher lets you take home your paper and like punch it up again and bring it back.
Yeah.
I mean that's very magnanimous.
Well, I think it's more about wanting to get the best script to the screen that you can. And, you know, this one particular script that I read, it was just, it needed this one little tweak. And I didn't tell him what to do. The guy, he did end up winning. It was because I don't tell them, you know, what favorites are mine, but I was the person who selected the finalists and then left it up to them. And then I would cast a vote if there was a tie, but there hasn't been yet. It's been the actors choosing it for now. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you see a writer's talent, and you know that they can fix it. It's like, the, you know, 95% of the script is amazing. If you could tweak this 5%, it's going to give you a better chance of winning based on what our actors think. And it's going to give us a better chance of having the best script possible. So,
and the second iteration, was that whole process of selecting the second script, was that done before or after First Person was making its rounds?
I'm trying to recall.
I would think the fact that you made First Person would have been a big deal, because I mean, I've heard of submit your script and we'll make one type contests, and then they never make one. So the fact that you really did it,
yeah,
I would think that your second, or if the time, the way the time worked, like your third year, like when you can show, like, look, we made First Person in it, did a festival run, and now it's on a series on Prime. I mean,
yeah.
You'd think that would
thank you
make the next thank you for making something good. You know, I would think that that would get people even more excited about it. The fact that you made something.
Yeah. You would hope. And right now we're at a place where we're not looking so good. It's like I need to hurry up and get this one produced, but it's still, I thought we were going to be able to do it this summer or this fall, but now that the COVID has come back around and is worse than before. And I just don't, I mean, we're going to try.
What people may not know is COVID, even if you can do things during COVID, it increases your costs.
Yeah.
Because you have to have COVID compliance and protecting people. And all of a sudden, a film you could have made, whatever, $10,000 in a weekend, all of a sudden the budget's doubled just because you have to keep people safe.
Right.
It's tough.
And you have to make sure that you're doing it all correctly in case a representative from SAG-AFTRA comes out to your set. So that's, like I said, while we do have the budget in place to make our second winner's film, it's kind of a coin toss right now as to when we're going to do it, just because
when is tough. But hey, I still say you get a buy on the delay because everything got delayed.
Yeah.
Hell, this podcast got delayed for over a year because I didn't have the emotional bandwidth to return to it. You know, it was just such a rough year.
Yeah.
For this planet.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, and to answer your prior question, I think it was definitely after we had finished producing First Person. I mean, I don't think I waited until its festival run was done to start up the second iteration. But either way, it's, yeah. We hope that it starts getting some more notoriety, the contest does, and that people hear about it and they're just like, dude, they actually do produce your film at the end. It's not just a pipe dream.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially once, I mean, even if it's delayed, when you get the second one done and then, once you have a couple done, then it's really going to stand. I think it will stand out.
I hope so.
I believe in it. I think it's a great idea.
Thank you. Yeah. I thought it was too, or wouldn't have started doing it and enlisted the help of my three buddies to help me get it off the ground. It's just been fantastic. The people who have volunteered their talents, with Charlie and Brina and Dean and Milena don't know who I'm going to ask yet for the third one, if it happens, but that'll be fun too.
Excellent. All right. Yeah. Well, congrats on that, and congrats on the auditions. I'll knock on, I got a wood floor here, knocking on wood. Something good will happen there.
Thank you.
And I'm going to wrap it up so that we can get to your four questions, because the next podcast after this one will be, you'll get to hear John's inspirations and whatnot. But, do you want to give, you gave shortscreenplay.com. Do you want to give a social media handle or something?
Yeah, there's also a short screen at short screenplay. What is it? Oh, I think it's at shortscreenplay.com, DOTCOM written out, I think, for Twitter, and which has been kind of dormant recently. But and then my own personal Instagram and Twitter are both at John Venable, and it's
you are blessed with a less common name. I have to say, yeah. Venable is you got at John Venable. That's awesome.
Here's a Hollywood note to go with that. The original model for the Columbia holding the torch up at the beginning of all the Columbia movies, that's Evelyn Venable. And evidently I'm distantly related to her. I don't know if this is true or not, but one of my aunts who did a lot of the research said it's true. So she might be like my eighth cousin or something.
I believe it. No, when you have truly rare Western European names, I know Thomas Lennon of Reno 911 and all mm-hmm. the amazing million things. Someone said,
he's written,
are you related to John Lennon? He goes, I don't really know if I believe it, but yeah, people in my family say like they can trace the tree because it's not that common a name.
Wow. That's cool.
Very cool.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm going to go on my spiel now to close us out.
Okay.
Which is, everyone should watch First Person. First Person is a hilarious movie and you can watch it. Just go to Amazon Prime Video, any way you get there,
and search for Discover Indie Film. Go to Season 3, Episode 1, and you can see First Person a lot, and it's followed by two hilarious films. And if you want to learn more, and by the way, give that 5 stars and give this podcast 5 stars while you're at it. So wherever you're reviewing, wherever you're watching, give everything that John does and everything that I do. Why don't you just give us 5 stars? Be a nice person. And if you want to learn more about this podcast or the TV series that sprang from it, go to discoveryindiefilm.com. And its social media is at DIFWINS. And, of course, the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that First Person was at in 2019, which was 2 years ago, and yet it was our last festival in person. You can learn about that festival. It's ranked in the top 100, actually, on Film Freeway. Go to ShermanOaksFF.com, and its social media is at ShermanOaksFF. And there happens to be a sister festival for Sherman Oaks. That's Film Invasion LA. Go to FilmInvasionLA.com or at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And that is the spiel.
Cool.
Thanks, John. And, hey, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.